The War of the Roses was over.
Or
so it seemed. Edward IV had, by bloody right of conquest, emerged victorious from the chaotic and blood-soaked preceding decades as the sole King of England and Lord of all the land around him. But he still had a mountain to climb. The wars had taken place fundamentally not really because of competing members of the Plantagenet dynasty, but because really, this country was an unstable polity. It was a failed state in all but name. Law and order seemed to have been totally eroded. Political instability was endemic. Rebellion and violence were commonplace. Edward had to somehow rebuild the nation out of this broken mess. And in the meantime, London? Well, London in this era was trying to rebuild also. The attempt to storm its walls in 1471 had killed hundreds and left the city scarred and marked with the signs of battle. The city's guilds were seeking to navigate their way through an economy that was hanging on for dear life. And everybody in the city was hoping for some reward for being stalwarts in their support of King Edward. Hi, my name is Saul. And this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to slowly tell the history of this amazing city chronologically, sometimes going into extraordinary details over events like last chapter, where the entire thing just covered about 6 weeks in the city story. And sometimes we cover several years, most of a decade, like this chapter. This will try to tell events from the point of view of the Londoners themselves, to allow us to understand why things happen from the mindset of those involved. And I hope, in a way that's a rather entertaining and cracking tale. And so this week, how London and England cope with Edward IV's rebuilding of the nation, and the false hope that the civil wars that had so gripped this country were finally over. They weren't, but nobody knew it at the time. Welcome then to chapter 171 of The Story of London, Edward's Web. The defence of London, the city had seen several significant blessings be given to those involved in the defence. The mayor, the mercer John Stockton, had been knighted for his actions during the attack, as had others, and these others would play significant roles in London's political scene over the next few years. The fishmonger William Hampton was also knighted in the aftermath of the battle. And after Stockton's term of office ended, and the pro-Yorkist grocer William Edwards, who'd been a significant financial backer to the king going back to the early 1460s, had served a year as mayor, the now Sir William Hampton was elected to the post of Mayor of London in 1472. The mercer John Tate II, also knighted for his defence of London during the siege, and he came from a long line of mercer mayors, then took over the office in 1473. And in 1476, the former mayor of London, Sir Ralph Jocelyn, the man who I mentioned last chapter, led the Londoners out to chase down the troops of the Bastard of Falkenberg after the battle, well, he was invited to serve his second term as mayor. While history may have forgotten that sudden and vicious attack upon the city in 1471, London at the time clearly thought it was important, with four out of the seven mayors of the city from 1471 to 1476 having been noted for their active and leading participation in that fight. You see, London then, with these kind of mayors in its own way, begin to try and aid the king in clamping down on the breakdown of law and order. Re-establishing law and order was crucial to any hope of restoring peace across the nation. And we see, for example, in 1472, it was ordered that each London ward should provide its own set of stocks and pillories for the punishment of minor criminals, to expand out the numbers who were taken to justice and to allow more to be punished. The streets of London at this time were, like now, filled with noise. In addition to the sounds of horses and the sounds of various carts travelling along the cobbled streets and the sounds of the myriad industries all pursuing their crafts, there was a constant chatter of people talking. You had the sing-song cries of market stall holders offering goods for sale. And on top of this, you had the seemingly never-ending parish funeral and guild processions which snaked their way through the crowded streets, all of which made a cacophony of sound. And adding to this was the fact that new laws, like the wards having to have their own stocks, were conveyed via the loud methods of official proclamations. Someone would go out into the street and shout them out loud for everyone to hear. The town crier, or in London's case, the city crier. It turns out that in this era, the Sergeant of Arms of London was designated the formal Common Crier of London, and he was a busy man. Take, for example, that law about the newly expanded stocks and pillories in 1472. These were noisy places, as the crier would usually go to the stocks and pillories and give public readings of the charges against those who'd been placed within them. The false bakers who gave a short measure of flour, the liars convicted of making up stories about their neighbours, and the salacious bawds and prostitutes brought out for public ridicule, all would have their crimes announced by the crier. But the criers also announced the proclamations on behalf of the king and the Lord Mayors. The crier was not only paid to recite aloud the city ordinances, but the common crier announced each will presented towards the hustings court and each plea terminated in the criminal court. If you wanted to know what was going on in the guild hall, you listened out for the common crier, who was also the city's mace bearer. For doing this rather tiring duty, the sergeant at arms was compensated with a fine robe or cloak, which he was given when he was sworn in. He was given a place to live in. He was given a horse that was respectable enough so as not to disgrace the city as he carried out his duties. And he received payments for the various announcements he made. The crier became a recognisable figure in livery and on horseback and was well known to virtually everyone in London. It was a tradition for the common crier to recite the basic ordinances of the city when a new mayor began his term. You know, reminding everyone of the prohibition against wandering the streets after curfew, or reminding folks it was forbidden to bear arms unless you're one of the king's sergeant-at-arms. He reminded hostelers loudly to warn their guests to lay aside their weapons before going out. And he vigorously reminded everyone in the name of the king's peace it was their duty to arrest felons and to deliver them to the city sheriffs. From his lips were repeated the rules of London, which stated that victuallers, the people who sold food, were to obey the regulations of the trade, that no taverner was to mix bad wine with good, that brewers were not allowed to sell ale at specific prices, that filth was to be removed from outside your homes, that your pigs were to be kept from wandering the streets, and so on. It was a lot of instruction to take in at once, really, and one wonders how many times and in what places these lengthy ordinances were proclaimed. But at least because of this, no one could plead ignorance of the law, and perhaps that was the purpose of this constant recital. Many proclamations were focused on keeping the peace. Sometimes the rules denote the social controls the city had placed upon the residents. One of my favourites, quote, that no manner of man nor child, of what estate or condition he may be so hardy to wrestle or make any wrestling within the sanctuary nor the bounds of St. Paul's, nor in one other open place within the city of London, upon pain of imprisonment for 40 days, unquote. Gee, wrestling, always been a problem. And they'd also get up and announce the banning of mummers' plays or the wearing of disguises in the streets over the Christmas period. Other proclamations concerned lighting, having a barrel of water ready in case of a fire, the endlessly repeated because everyone ignored it, keeping of the curfew. The inhabitants were continually kept informed, directed and threatened by the common crier's public announcements. But there was also written instruction in London at this era. All over the streets, as we have said, were often bills of political propaganda posted on the city gates, on walls of houses, on church doors. But because they were made of paper, we have little record of their content. Certainly they were read and repeated to those who could not read. Long-term listeners would know we've already covered how the Lollards' heretical manifestos appeared on church doors in the early 15th century, and various political poems were often mentioned throughout the years. We know the likes of the Earl of Warwick supporters would post political treaties giving justification of his actions. We know Richard Duke of York also did this. And if you remember a few chapters ago, we saw a brilliant example of anti-Yorkist propaganda where severed dogs' heads were set on posts in Fleet Street and each head had a verse in their mouth complaining about how it had been sacrificed to the Duke of York's ambition. These rules of London, proclaimed by the criers, also implored and reminded everyone that, as we said, they were expected to arrest felons and deliver them to the sheriffs, encouraging the residents to police stuff going on outside their own front door. But this could have rather dramatic side effects. We know from the coroner's inquests of these times that people in the street would often reprimand those they perceived to be guilty of misbehaviour, and this could escalate. For example, when two men attempted to cheat a man selling Costard apples in the street, he raised a hue and cry. They tried to carry off 5 apples from his table, but a passerby reprimanded the two men. These two men then followed this Good Samaritan and threatened him until he turned round and smacked one of them over the head with his staff. In another case, an esquire of the Earl of Arundel was riding very quickly through the street, and he accidentally ran into a woman carrying a child in her arms. A porter called John Le Harway, quote, begged him to ride more carefully, unquote. Probably with slightly more colourful language than that. But then the esquire was so affronted by what he said that he actually hit him with his sword. And in another case, two Londoners reprimanded a groom who worked for one of the princes because they found him urinating in a public lane. They later claimed that they had informed him that there were public privies in the city and should go there if he had to relieve himself. He claimed they assaulted him with a knife, but he did not press charges and he was later fined, both for lying and, we imagine, pissing in the street. This was an era where a woman was murdered by her husband, a Breton, who, after committing the crime, fled to a church to claim sanctuary. But the women of the local parish that woman was killed in decided to wait for him. And after his 40 days in sanctuary, where according to the rules he was to be escorted by constables out of the country, they fell upon him and started stoning him, leaving him dead. Should we be surprised at such drastic action? This was the same city whose streets were filled with the regular rhythm of public processions of traitors going from the Tower to Tyburn for hanging, drawing and quartering, and the sad processions of Lollards being taken to Smithfield for burning. As well as sound, this was a city also bombarded with images, decorations upon its buildings designed to impress upon its populations lessons of civic virtue and responsibility, lessons of history. The gates of the city often featured rulers. Ludgate had images of the mythic King Lud and other kings upon it. As part of the reconciliation between King Richard II and London way back in 1392, which we covered in chapter 141, the king had demanded that the citizens place painted stone statues of himself and his Queen Anne above the stone gate of London Bridge. And for me, one of the best examples came up during this era. Bishopsgate was rebuilt in 1479, most probably because of the damage caused to it by the fighting in 1471. And the work to rebuild it was funded by the Hanse merchants in the Steelyard. On Bishopsgate was a statue of the ancient Norman Bishop William of London, flanked on one side by a statue of King Alfred, and next to him, the Ealdorman Æthelred of Mercia. These were figures from London's ancient history, men whose lives we covered all the way back in chapter 14 of the story. Now, as the narrator and writer of this podcast, I will admit a degree of conceit and personal focus. when I described the battle last chapter and then evoked the city's ancient past and the myriad battles against the Vikings. However, this rebuilding of Bishopsgate shows that that was clear at the time and that the Londoners did exactly the same thing. For me, it seems poignant that when London rebuilt Bishopsgate, the site of ferocious fighting to defend the city against invaders, they placed a statue of Ealdorman Æthelred of Mercia, who had led Londoners out to battle the forces of Hastin, as we covered back in chapter 15. This noisy city, then, existed in a way where the past influenced the present, even as it moved forward. But this conflict between how things are and how things were going to be caused tensions. And sometimes these tensions appeared in the most unexpected places. My favourite story from this decade. In 1477, the Mercers and the Grocers, two of the most prestigious and wealthy livery companies dealing in long-distance trade, had a huge falling out about where they would stand during ceremonial occasions in St. Paul's Cathedral. As I've mentioned in previous chapters, during the decades leading up to this, the Mercers were growing in wealth and status, and the Grocers had begun to go into decline. But the argument began when the Mercers complained that the Grocers had, quote, unlovingly and unkindly, unquote, taken their place at the celebrations of All Hallows. And they complained that this had caused, quote, rancor and great malice, especially by means of uncourteous language on their part, unquote. Now, this Feast of All Hallows, which we now know as All Saints' Day, November the 1st, turns out that was a major celebration for the city. That ancient book of London's precedences, the Liber Albus, dictated that on this day, quote, the mayor was wont, together with his household, to proceed after dinner to the church of St. Thomas, and also the aldermen and the people of the mayor's livery, who met together there with the substantial men of several maesteries, arrayed in their respective suits, unquote. And then, after meeting the mayor, they would all take a formal procession back to St. Paul's Church to hear Vespers. In other words, All Saints' Day was this huge ceremony. It's one of those civic spectacles that provided occasions for a display of who had power, who had precedence, and who was the best dressed, who had the best bling. And such occasions were seen and heard by the population, who were watching a solemn Christian parade, but were also reading into it who was top dog, who had power, who was losing power. And so what had happened was the Grocers were pushing back at the growth in power by the Mercers by basically taking their place in the church during the ceremony and clearly telling them where to stick themselves when the Mercers argued. This argument actually festered for a few weeks. And in the end, the Mercers' solution was to find an alderman of London who was a member of their guild and ask him to approach the mayor about organising a meeting with delegations from the two livery companies. Now, this meeting was not an official one held at the guild hall. Instead, the parties were summoned to a meeting at the southwest end of the cloister of St. Paul's Cathedral between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning of December 24th. There on Christmas Eve in 1477, in St. Paul's, was a heated discussion. The mayor, the goldsmith Humphrey Hayford, pointed out that the Mercers had always stood in the spot they claimed the Grocers had taken from them. And he said they should continue to do so and take pride of place in all the processions as they have been doing these last few years. The Grocers, to be honest, responded in a rather sulky manner, and they kind of requested they would want a good place to stand, and the mayor agreed that they could stand on the steps going up to the choir. But what sounds like a simple moment of the mayor sighing and going, "Oh, for God's sake, stop pushing folks away from their usual place, will you?" actually contains a surprising amount of depth that went into the goldsmith's decision. You see, he ruled on the precedent of long-standing, an argument that held particular weight in medieval London, an argument that basically said, if we've been doing it for years, that's the way it's done, and thou shalt not change it. As well as this, he decided to settle the dispute during the holy season, when messages of peace and reconciliation would seem most appropriate. But the matter had to be resolved by waiting until December 24th to hold the meeting, because on December 25th, the Nativity, and on December 26th, St. Stephen's Day, there were even more magnificent and important processions of the mayor, the aldermen, the sheriffs, and the worthies going to St. Paul's. A fight over which guild will stand where would have been totally out of place for such a public and solemn occasion. By taking advantage of the solemnity of the season, the mayor's settlement was much more likely to be embedded and succeed because it invoked a divine element in its solution. Having been sealed by practice on Christmas Day the following day, it was binding thereafter. The mercers stood in their usual place, and the grocers took up their new one. And thus, London resolved its myriad problems. The decade saw the city turn to improve itself, as it often did after a crisis. In 1473, William Pole, a man who was a leper and a follower of Edward IV, was granted a piece of land on Highgate Hill, which he could found the Hospital of St. Anthony for the treatment of leprosy. Let's be honest, however, there was no treatment of those who suffered from leprosy back then. And really, such places were used for the containment of unfortunate victims. Highgate Leper Hospital was built on a plot of land that measured merely 60 feet by 34 feet. 2 years later, another leper hospital was established outside of the city walls in a place designated as only being fit for the socially unacceptable lepers of this world. So obviously they picked Knightsbridge to put this. In 1475, the Hants merchants of the Steelyard up in Upper Thames Street, a place now completely covered by Cannon Street Station, were actually permitted to buy the freehold of the building they had possessed for years. Remember, the German merchants who lived there, while being giants in London's trade, were actually forced to live rather austere lives. Life in the Steelyard was closer to that of a collegiate monastery than a bastion of medieval capitalism. No member was allowed to visit a woman or to marry while they lived there. They had to be in the premises by a fixed hour of the clock at night, and they had to dine communally. But these Germans, and London's link to these Germans, especially to the trade centre of Cologne, was now to play a huge role in the city story going forward. Cologne and London had always been very close as cities. I mean, when the Hanseatic League had gone to war with England, Cologne itself had temporarily removed themselves from the Hanseatic League so they could protect their links to London. And right now, the exchange of German merchants from Cologne to the Steelyard and London merchants to the streets of Cologne saw the most important dividend ever to come out of that ancient relationship. And now we need to briefly talk about William Caxton. Caxton was a mercer by origin of trade, and from that he'd become a leading merchant adventurer, and ended up holding several positions leading London's merchants over on the continent. After many years of building his reputation as an honourable man and gaining the trust of several Germanic merchants, in 1471 he planned to go to Cologne to learn the craft of printing, and stayed there from the 17th of July 1471 to near Christmas 1472, learning how to print in a city that had 10 printers by 1475. He then set up shop in Bruges, where he paid for and oversaw the production of an edition of the great Latin encyclopedia written by Bartholomew the Englishman, a folio volume of nearly 500 pages. This was produced in the printing house of Johann Velderen, the man who had acted as Caxton's tutor in the craft of printing and was to continue to supply him with letter types all through his printing career. Caxton also completed a translation of the histories of Troy in 1471 and a story of the 11,000 Virgins and Saint Ursula, which regular listeners may well remember. Having learned his art, then, via the Merchants of Cologne, Caxton returned to London and set up shop in the precincts of Westminster Abbey. He was the first printer in England, and his contribution to the cultural history of the English language is immense. Those books he had printed on the continent were the first English language books to be typeset and published, and the first known document from his Westminster press was an indulgence granted by the Abbot of Abingdon. But then, by the 18th of November in 1477, he'd produced a book, The Dictates and Sayings of the Philosophers, which had been translated by none other than Earl Rivers himself. During this decade, he produced an edition of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, and he would go on to produce the first printed version of La Mort d'Arthur and Ovid's Metamorphoses. And for the next 15 years, Caxton printed 96 books or editions. Publishing in England began with Caxton. And that began with the relationship between London and Cologne. In 1477, we see restoration work begin on the city wall. As the recent events had shown, the city wall was far from being merely decorative. It was a crucial aspect in the city's defence in an unstable and wild land wrecked with political instability. In 1477, it was felt that the northern section of the wall needed a major renovation. The city's authorities decided that it should be repaired with bricks made from Moorfields clay, but it should be paid for by the parishioners of the north side of the city, who were to pay sixpence each Sunday for the work. And it's perhaps no coincidence that on April 21st of 1477, the city appointed a man called Edward Stone as its first clerk of the city's works. That position would continue right the way down to the famous James Bunning in 1843, and after him the title was changed to that of the city architect. And so, London, externally as a social place, began to recover from the privations and the chaos of the civil wars. Meanwhile, Edward IV entered this decade finally the master of his kingdom. This time, he was not doomed. This time his reign was not a tragedy. Now he could refashion England in his own image. The 29-year-old king was still young, still energetic, still ready to grapple with issues before him. But now he was tempered by war and slaughter. He had proven himself to be the warlord without power. Now he was sure he would become the king without equal. Domestically, he and Queen Elizabeth began to expand the royal family. His eldest daughter, Elizabeth, was 6 at this point. Her sisters, Mary and Cecily, were 2 and 3. Their brother, the much-hoped-for, cherished Prince Edward, was, on 11th of June 1471, formally named Prince of Wales and Earl of Chester in a ceremony at Westminster Abbey, the great titles placed upon the head of the 7-month-year-old baby. Edward and Elizabeth would produce 6 more children during the next few years, and around Edward was now being created a large and eager young royal dynasty to carry his legacy forward to at least the next generation. And around this growing family, Edward IV then established one of the most extravagant and glorious royal courts in Europe. He wanted a royal court whose majesty and wealth would match any of any English king before it and would impress any foreign visitor with its command of fashion, style. I mean, when he started, sure, he was kind of copying the dazzling court of the Dukes of Burgundy. But quickly he moved to go beyond that. This was an English court which evoked the glories of the early part of the reign of Edward III. Its grandness began to manifest itself in building works. His reconstruction of the chapel of the College of St. George at Windsor, the spiritual home of the Order of the Garter, stood out, a soaring masterpiece of Gothic architecture, King Edward IV spent over £6,500 just improving Windsor Castle alone, and the royal court paid for the rebuilding of castles and palaces across England, including Westminster, Greenwich and Eltham. But these outward displays of grandeur is not what England needed most. The state itself had to be rebuilt. The decline of law and order needed to be addressed. And since the principal cause of many of England's issues over the last few decades was the behaviour and comportment of the powerful landowners, Edward had a chance to really work on this. The deaths of the Earl of Warwick, his brother Lord Montague and several other rebels had created huge swathes of land that the king could reassign in the southwest of England, up in the north and across the West Midlands. Edward's also reclaimed land that had been given away by the crown in the past, allowing him to hold much of the kingdom in his own hands. And with this, he began to distribute ownership of land, and with it tax revenues, and with it wealth and power, much more carefully, redistributing the land, the titles, the offices and authorities, like the beginning of some kind of political spider's web. He could and did target the more unstable regions of the country with men he could trust, many of whom were members of his family. The Earl of Warwick's massive estates were largely split between his two brothers. It meant that in the Midlands, the eternal middle child, Duke Clarence, was entrusted with land and a limited degree of autonomy and power. But King Edward made sure that his problematic and spoilt brother was eclipsed by his most trusted servant, military captain and companion, William Lord Hastings. Each part of the web was carefully spun into place. Edward was connecting the royal dynasty in a way not seen since Edward III. The king's children, his brothers, their cousins, all had links to the state and to him, and there he sat in the middle, now becoming a mercurial spider spinning a web which would help him to weave together this kingdom. Stability was all. He understood that local politics could so easily escalate. He remembered how some small rebellion in some faraway province could be the cause for a national shift in politics. He'd seen how small disputes in Kent could end up with London being besieged. He was determined not to allow the crown overlook local politics. He appointed men connected to his household to serve as local justices of the peace and sheriffs. And they would sit on itinerant judicial commissions, and these basically reinforced the royal will and manifest the power of the royal court across the country in small regions. The level of direct crown involvement in the governance of England began to be planted deep into the soil of the nation. The king was determined to bring stability, a stability he hoped would last for generations. The glue to all this, the elements of this grand web rested upon them, were the king's most trusted men, and there was none more trusted than Edward IV's younger brother, Richard, the Duke of Gloucester. In the aftermath of 1471, he was recognised as a crucial part of the king's state, and he was rewarded accordingly. He was given both as a reward and duty the Neville estates in northern England, traditionally endlessly filled with turmoil and danger, whose border with Scotland made things worse. To run those estates required a leader who was completely loyal to the king, had decent military skill, certainly did not lack in courage, and could also be a cunning son of a bitch. Characteristics Richard, Duke of Gloucester, had displayed over the course of the recent crisis. To help him in 1472, the Duke of Gloucester was married to Warwick's younger daughter, Anne Neville. Gloucester was also awarded huge tracts of land from the Duchy of Lancaster and was given effective seniority over Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland. He went on to hold lands in Wales and East Anglia, as well as serving officially as the Constable of England and the Admiral of England. Richard was on the rise like no other noble in the country. The young man was only 22, and it was about now, however, that people noticed that he started to display the symptoms of the scoliosis he suffered from, a curvature of the spine, which apparently caused him to walk with his right shoulder slightly raised and his back slightly hunched. He was not a hunchback, though, as described by Shakespeare. Apparently you couldn't notice if he was wearing armour. And accounts of him say at the time that he was mostly noted for his height, he was 5'8", and the fact that he was rather skinny with delicate arms and legs. And yet he was also the cornerstone of his older brother's kingdom, a very ruthless hatchet man. However, the king's middle brother, George, Duke of Clarence, was the complete opposite. It is worth remembering that this spoilt and petulant little shit had been the principal cause for Edward losing his throne a few years ago. But despite that, he benefited from Edward's mercy and patience and forgiving nature, yet he continued to be an annoying arsehole. The partition of the Warwick estate caused no small amount of friction between him and his brother, the Duke of Gloucester, from 1472 until 1474. Friction that ended up in disorder throughout the Midlands, and a growing headache for the king. Slowly, Edward realised that the Duke of Clarence was going to continue to be a pain in his ass. And that was not the king's only problem. That grand and magnificent royal court Edward was showing off to all the world, it should be said he was spending lavishly at a time when the royal coffers were empty, and the government was only staying afloat because of a series of massive loans being taken out from the London branch of the Medici Bank. Opportunities to raise taxes for the king, to begin with, were limited as the country needed to take some time to recover from the Civil War. Taxes paid by the Calais staple normally amounted to about a third of all royal revenue, and they would have been really valuable to the king had they been available. You see, despite the death of Warwick and Edward's crushing victory at the Battle of Tewkesbury, Calais remained loyal to Warwick, and Warwick's deputy, Lord Wenlock, had left Calais to join Queen Margaret's force as she prepared to set sail for England, and he'd left a man called Sir Walter Wrottesley in charge of Calais. When Wenlock had died at Tewkesbury, Wrottesley had sent a man called Sir George Brooke with a contingent of 300 men from the Calais garrison to fight against Edward IV, and it was these men who had turned up last chapter fighting under the banner of Thomas Neville, the Bastard of Falkenberg. After that campaign failed, it was these men who returned to Calais. Meanwhile, Edward had decided round about 1472 or 3 or so that he wanted to entrust the vital town of Calais to his loyal supporter Baron Hastings. But although Edward really did trust Hastings, he'd learned his lesson. He was not going to give anyone the power that Warwick had been able to wield as the captain of Calais. Hastings, therefore, was given the less powerful post of lieutenant of Calais. Hastings arrived in June that year, but found that Wrottesley still resisted the king and defended Calais against him. The subsequent siege of Calais lasted for 2 months before Wrottesley finally came to terms and surrendered in exchange for a royal pardon. The vital fortress of Calais was finally back in Lord Hastings' possession, and Edward was at least reasonably safe upon his throne with some money coming in. So, borrowing vast amounts of cash from Italians, and with Calais now at least back under the control of the loyal Stapler faction of merchants of London, which meant they could give Edward his first regular stream of cash, now Edward was financially secure and could concentrate on, you know, indulging his newly found appetite for holding feasts, having many mistresses, and living in general splendour. Yet for all of this, there was a part of him that still felt that it wasn't enough that he should look the part. He wanted to express his newfound success in deeds. And so he turned his attention to France and the need to regain the lost English territory and perhaps, yeah, the throne of France. Yes, folks, while everyone says the Hundred Years' War is over by now, guess what? It isn't. The damn near 150 Years' War has restarted again. And I mean, it wasn't just him restarting the war for the sake of it. Edward IV actually did want to go after King Louis XI of France, because that perfidious French git had supported Queen Margaret and Warwick when their campaign and, well, the final last remaining nominal figurehead of Henry VI's cause, the son of his half-brother, a small precocious child called Henry Tudor, was still being given shelter over in France. Now, thought the king, Louis XI needed to get a punch in his face. Edward IV was going to go to war with France. But think about it from Edward's point of view. He'd already fought personally in 10 battles, and had never lost a single one. He was a proven commander on a 10-fight winning streak, and this was the scrap he figured he actually had a chance of winning. Maybe Edward IV could emulate the successes of his grandfather, Edward III, in France, and wouldn't that be something? The actual circumstances seemed perfect for a successful campaign. In the previous year, 1473, he'd not only resolved the destabilizing arguments going on between his brothers over who owned which land, he'd also sorted out a truce with Scotland, which meant he didn't have to worry about his northern border. Furthermore, the very powerful Duke Charles of Burgundy was his brother-in-law, and Charles of Burgundy wanted to break from France and establish himself as the king of his own large and prosperous territories. And the situation had been brought to a head when Duke Charles and his ally, the Duke of Brittany, formally asked Edward to align with them against King Louis XI. Edward had Calais as a secure base from which to launch an attack upon France with, in conjunction with Burgundy and Brittany. And then he was told that these two had been joined the Count de Saint-Pol, the Constable of France, in a giant coalition against King Louis. This was brilliant. The timing was perfect. He needed to start the war now. The only problem was he really didn't have enough money to raise a large army and then transport it to Calais. Fortunately for the king, Parliament was very enthusiastic about another war with France. This is what kings of England should be doing, stomping around the muddy fields of that country, not on blessed English soil. Parliament basically granted Edward a number of huge subsidies, including one for 31,460 quid. Having suddenly accumulated a shed load of money and supported by an aristocracy rather eager for war, Edward soon assembled an army of about 1,500 men at arms and 15,000 archers. On June 22nd, 1475, this great force departed from Sandwich and arrived safely in Calais. An army of this size, under an experienced leader such as Edward, allied with Burgundy and Brittany, should have been enough to make King Louis tremble in fear. Having arrived in Calais, Edward wanted to make his intentions perfectly clear to the French king. He dispatched his herald with a letter to King Louis. The herald was received by the French king, who read the letter, and in it he found was nothing less than King Edward demanding the crown of France. Now, King Louis surprised many as he appeared to treat this threat very seriously. There were no angry displays of defiance. King Louis took the herald politely to his privy closet and there, in a most courteous manner, told him he was sorry for this misunderstanding with the English king, that for his part he had the highest respect for King Edward and he wanted to be on amicable terms with him. The herald rode back to find King Edward. But while he had been away, Edward IV had started his campaign and he marched out gloriously to what turned out to be something that was, well, a little bit shite. The Duke of Brittany had promised tens of thousands of soldiers, but in the end he sent Edward 2,000 archers. You can almost hear Edward through the ages reviewing this force from Brittany sent to him, going, Is this it? Meanwhile, Duke Charles of Burgundy, his main ally, had become somewhat distracted by deciding to start a war against the Duke of Lorraine. And when he finally appeared at Edward's camp, he brought with him a small retinue of bodyguards rather than any large army. And he explained that I would be unable to provide any forces for that campaign season. Edward IV's response was the 15th century version of the phrase, "Oh, for God's sake." Edward was growing furious. His grand coalition was now really just him and a couple of symbolic gestures of help. Still, he went solid and decided to press on and advance to the town of Saint-Quentin. The Duke of Burgundy accompanied Edward and assured him that the Constable of Saint-Pol, who was in control of Saint-Quentin, would open the gates upon their arrival. But not only did Saint-Quentin not open its gates, it proceeded to fire arrows at Edward's troops. Edward was furious and made his feelings known in no fucking uncertain terms to the Duke Charles's face. And he said it so strongly and so forcefully that the Duke of Burgundy actually fled the English camp. for Edward, the San Quentin debacle was the last straw that broke the Burgundian alliance. And it was just then, with Edward fuming at his brother-in-law, that his herald returned from his visit from Louis. The herald's report of what Louis offered was well received by Edward. It actually gave him a way of punishing his bloody useless brother-in-law. Edward called a council, which concluded that with, you know, winter approaching, supplies beginning to run low, and with no assistance from their so-called allies, it was probably prudent to launch peace negotiations. And negotiations took place over the following couple of months, during which Louis made sure that all the English plenipotentiaries had lots of French gold given to them to encourage them to, you know, find peace. The outcome was a treaty signed near Amiens in August 1475. The treaty agreed that a seven-year truce between the two countries would be in effect, and that King Louis would pay King Edward 75,000 crowns immediately, and then a further 50,000 crowns a year during the rest of their lives. As an additional bonus, Louis agreed to offer to pay a further 50,000 crowns to ransom Queen Margaret, who had spent the last 4 years as a prisoner of Edward, as an additional undertaking, just to add icing on the cake and to further bind this new French and English alliance. It was agreed that Edward's eldest daughter, Elizabeth, would one day marry the Dauphin of France when they both came of age. I mean, this allowed Edward the satisfaction to know that his daughter would one day be Queen of France and that any of his grandchildren would succeed to the French throne. However, although the treaty was in many ways very advantageous to Edward IV, there was nothing in it that would pay off the English nobility who had voted for this war and raised a fortune, and nothing in it to appease the soldiers in his army who had joined on the very real expectation of booty and plunder. Oddly enough, King Louis XI of France was very aware that the treaty could be massively unpopular with a majority of Edward's army. He therefore took great pains to sweeten the pill for them. 300 cartloads of his best French wine were sent to the English camp to help quench the bloodthirsty English soldiers. Louis made a particular effort to win over the English nobles. He invited them to Amiens, where they were richly entertained and given wonderful food. Those who supported the treaty were rewarded, and even those who were not were given gifts of money, plate, or horses. King Louis's charm offensive had been expensive, but it worked well for him. He is reported to have remarked that whereas his ancestors had been forced to fight to get the English out of France, he'd done it with gifts of wine, cheese, and pâté. For his part, Edward marched his army to Calais and they returned to England, but without the hoped-for plunder or occupation of French territory, let alone the crown of France. Despite all the PR from King Louis, there was little doubt in the minds of most Englishmen that King Edward IV had sold out his honour and the nation for a French pension. Still, that may be a bit harsh. Sure, he'd been manipulated by King Louis, but that being said, the campaign season was coming to an end with no support from his allies. He really had little option but to return his army to England. He at least obtained cash from Louis to cover the cost of this campaign and an annual French payment. This was actually of far more value to the royal exchequer and the nation than paying out for year-on expenses of another campaign in a country as large as France. And so, now, he was financially secure. And for the remainder of his reign, King Edward concentrated on enjoying the luxuries of monarchy. His many mistresses multiplied and his magnificent court grew even more magnificent. Edward knew that such a lifestyle needed financial support, so he ordered a rigorous renewal of how crown revenue was brought in by fully exploiting the collection of customs duties, tithes to clergy and feudal dues. He also converted his transport ships, which had been designed for moving troops across the Channel, into trading vessels. This merchant navy took with it tin, cloth and other merchandise to be traded in ports as far away as the Levant and returned to England with the products off the East. So successful was his renewed focus that after a couple of years, Edward became simply the wealthiest monarch in Europe. This emphasis on trade rather than costly warfare was particularly welcome in Calais and London. The commerce of the town had suffered continual disruption during the War of the Roses. With hostilities at an apparent end and with a 7-year truce with France in place, merchants now seemed able to unleash their potential. And we'll go over how this increase in trade was to impact London in a future chapter. But after all of this, towards the end of the decade at home, Edward's brother, the Duke of Clarence, remained a problem. He was hated by the Queen. I mean, you can understand why. He was responsible for the death of her father and her brother. And he also hated her back, and he continued to plot against her Woodville relations. Clarence was immensely rich, don't forget, but nothing was ever enough for him. In January 1477, Duke Charles of Burgundy died fighting in his war against the Duke of Lorraine. Charles's only surviving child was his 19-year-old daughter from his first marriage, Mary, and she inherited his vast empire. Suddenly, Mary had become the single most prominent heiress in the whole of Christendom. Coincidentally, the Duke of Clarence's wife, Isabella of Warwick, had died a month earlier, and he quickly overcame his grief and requested Mary's hand in marriage. Such a marriage would make Clarence one of the most powerful rulers in Europe. Consider that at the same time, when the Duke of Burgundy, Charles, died, his provinces were being ruled on his daughter's Mary's behalf by her stepmother, his widow, Duchess Margaret. And Duchess Margaret was the sister of King Edward and the Duke of Clarence. Margaret supported a potential marriage between her brother and her stepdaughter. But King Edward was completely opposed to so much power passing to his useless brother. I mean, he's been a shit for most of his adult life. Do we really want him to be that powerful? Edward was persuaded by Queen Elizabeth, his wife, to put forward her brother, Lord Rivers, as a candidate for Mary's hand, but the court of Burgundy refused, as Rivers was considered too lowborn, and Margaret eventually looked to France and Austria for prospective suitors for Mary. Clarence was furious that his ambitions had been thwarted by Edward, and he did everything in his power to undermine the king and the queen. There followed a period in which the Duke of Clarence was as difficult and as obstructive as he could be, but then he overstepped himself and accused the queen of sorcery. On the 10th of June in 1477, the Duke of Clarence was summoned to an audience with the king, the mayor of London, and the aldermen of the city. And there they witnessed the king unleash in person on his brother before commanding him that he be thrown into the Tower of London. This was sensational. The Mayor of London, the goldsmith, Sir Humphrey Hayford, and his aldermen witnessed this amazing spectacle of a king suddenly imprisoning his closest adult relative and prepared to put him on trial before the Lords in Parliament. Wow! And when the Parliament of January 1478 assembled before the king in the Painted Chamber, it was clear to everyone that right now, the Duke of Clarence was done. The preceding Parliament, which had gathered in the autumn of 1477, had seen the leading lords, led by the Woodville family, present a case against Clarence, which extended to, well, as well as his politics, to his abuse of the judicial process. You see, after his first wife died, Clarence had somehow got it into his head that some poor woman who lived nearby had poisoned her, even though there was no evidence for this, and he basically organised a kangaroo court to find her guilty, or else. This had been a pretty scandalous and terrible abuse of law and order. In January 1478, this and all of the Duke's past misdemeanours had been bundled together of a single block of allegations that basically said, this guy, he's the shit. And then on top of this, that Parliament was then packed with retainers, servants, and associates of the King and Queen. What followed was some of the most vicious political drama seen in Parliament in decades. Edward IV, with no other legal counsel, delivered his case against his brother in person. Quote, "Not a single person uttered a word against the Duke, except the King," unquote, wrote one witness. And he also noticed that the Duke of Clarence was refused the right of attorney in his defence. Quote, "Not one individual made answer to the King, except the Duke," unquote. Anyone with any sense could see the Duke of Clarence was done. He was being systematically destroyed legally by his own brother. Eventually and inevitably, early in February 1478, proceedings were wound up and Henry Stafford, the Duke of Buckingham, the King's brother-in-law through his marriage to Catherine Woodville, stood in Parliament and delivered the verdict. Clarence was convicted of treason, having been judged guilty on a bewildering number of charges. These were written out in full in a bill of attainder later passed against him, and that bill was signed by King Edward's own hand. The King dithered for a few days about whether to carry out the sentence that his brother's supposed crimes demanded. He dithered for so long, the Parliamentary Commons complained about the delay. But then, on the 18th of February, George, Duke of Clarence, died in the Tower of London. The exact method of his death has never been established. There's a long tradition that holds that he was plunged headfirst into a barrel of Malmsley wine and drowned. The Duke of Clarence was known to be partial to Malmsley wine, a sweet Madeiran, but this description of the manner of his death was probably said as a joke. It seems much more likely that someone, possibly agents working for his ruthless younger brother, the Duke of Gloucester, just done him in. The web that Edward IV had spun had been spun by a deadly spider. And make no mistake, Edward IV was becoming an increasingly dangerous spider indeed. He had, by the end of this decade, begun to grow fat from his lavish feasts. He no longer rode to battle, and he put on weight and only exercised with the young women who he increasingly took to his bed, while his loyal queen looked the other way. Still, England was mostly at peace. The royal coffers were better. Law and order was being restored, even if, you know, it was the king being bloody harsh on anybody. But people could accept that. Better that than the chaos of the last few years, yeah. Things were getting better, even if everybody began to be terrified all the time and worried where the web was leading them to. And we'll get to that next chapter. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope wherever you are, you've had a really good week. Ah, yes, we're moving through October, coming up to Halloween, decorations everywhere. This is Saul. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye.